Welcome to the Lloyds of History, a podcast connecting the past to the present and improving historical and political literacy. I'm your host, Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay, and we're going to continue our mini-series on the fall of the French Third Republic. And Jay, before we dive in, the more we go through these episodes and we talk about the fall of the French Third Republic, and as we get closer to World War II, and we touched on it in our last episode, I can't help but feel an eerie similarity to the U.S. and just the a lot of what was going on with the sense of decline, the kind of passive nature, the internal strife, which was occurring between the left and the right in France and caused inadequacy. The leaders of France and a lot of the allies at the time were, to put it mildly, uninspiring. I hit on this in the last episode where if you have uninspiring leaders, you can't expect a nation to go fight for slogans that, they're vestigial slogans that meant something to their grandfathers, but because of weak leaders, they no longer really believe in them. They're not going to want to fight. And you just see kind of like feels just like a decay in French society from the ground up, top to bottom, just complete and utter rot. And despite them having what would be considered the most advanced military in the world at the time and having this great defensive position on the Maginot Line and alliances across Europe and with the U.S., you just can't help. I mean, we obviously know what's going to happen, but even for them, it had to feel like the inevitable was coming. What do you think?
Yeah. And, this is episode 6, and we've been talking for 5 episodes on our 6th now on just the slow train wreck that is France. And it's also easy for us to kind of look back and go, oh, it was inevitable. Like, of course it looked like it, but it's worth mentioning, like, it didn't look that way to them at the time. And I think that's one of the things that we want to parse out is like, no, here were the obvious signs that they weren't seeing, and see how we can apply that to today.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point, I guess, of our podcast is to show the similarities between historical events and today. So you can parse them. You, the listener, can kind of parse through what you see on the news and you read online and say, how does this match up and how should we make our decisions moving forward? Does appeasement necessarily work? Can we have a total decline in virtue and civic and martial virtue and expect to hold together an empire? Difficult questions to ask. What's that? Yeah.
I said probably not what you were saying to the decline of virtue.
Of course not, because those are all empires. I referenced empires that had already fallen, of course.
Yeah, it's for me, I've really enjoyed doing this France thing. It's been really enlightening to kind of see, not just the details, but just how relevant it is to us today. And in this episode, we're going to get to the actual event. We're going to get to the actual Germans marching into Paris and talk through, in a little detail what happened, but really, really talk about the implications. And
that's good, because everybody now, you ask people like, well, what about the French, the French surrendering? And that's all they know is like the French surrender. They really... I think a lot of people now don't understand the run-up that we've talked through and seen all these events occur. And then even with the German invasion of France, they really don't know a lot of the details other than the French surrendered in a matter of weeks.
Yes. So in World War I, the German massive onslaught that came through Belgium and Alsace-Lorraine, the French were able to hold it for 4 years, right? From August of 1914 to November of 1918, like, they held the line. And there were Germans never showed up in Paris. As a matter of fact, most of the really bad fighting, especially from the British perspective, took place in Belgium. But in World War II, and what we're going to talk about today, from the initiation of, Heinz Guderian and his tanks rolling through the Ardennes to an armistice was 6 weeks. 6 weeks. Like, talk about, you know, we talked about Mark Bloch at the beginning writing about, like, it will be many years before the stain of 1940 is effaced from our national history. Like, you held off an enemy for 4 years, and this time around you couldn't even do it for 6 weeks. It was quite the astonishing turnaround. I guess, Colin, if it's all right with you, I wanted to start this episode with the German strategy.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because there's some interesting details here. You know, in our last episode, we talked about the fall of Poland, and we talked about some mistakes that, you know, the French and the British, really just the Allies, made in putting maybe a little bit too much trust in the Poles. Think, you know, Gamelin, who was the French senior military guy, he thought the Poles could hold out for 6 months. And that way the French could stage like an amphibious assault in northern Germany, or more likely actually send troops through Romania, like get them through the Mediterranean into the Black Sea, through Turkey, around Bulgaria and into Romania. That was what Gamelin wanted to do, and he thought he had 6 months to do it. And Poland fell in like a matter of weeks. And there was one guy in France who was looking at the fall of Poland and going, whoa, this changed everything. And that was Charles de Gaulle. I think many Americans should be familiar with Charles de Gaulle because he later became the president of France. He was the leader of the government in exile. This episode, we're going to really talk about what happened up till the armistice. And in our next episode, we'll talk about Vichy France and, you know, some of the key players there, what happened in Vichy France. And we'll wrap things up there. De Gaulle did not support Vichy France. He fled to London and proclaimed a government in exile, that was, you know, known as Free France, as opposed to Vichy France. And de Gaulle was a pretty significant political figure in post-World War II Europe. Well, de Gaulle was all about the tanks, and he saw the Germans. One of the more novel things, actually the novel thing that Germans employed with the tank and with armor, was they created entire divisions of just tanks. And at the time of 1940, the Germans would enlist 10 pure panzer divisions against the Allies, Netherlands, France, and Belgium. And whereas France and Gamelin, you know, we have a whole episode that talked about the brain drain in the French high command and how they saw the tactics and the strategy that came out of World War One as what would save them in the future. They viewed tanks as supporting the arms of the infantry. And you can imagine infantry is primarily on foot. And so if your tanks exist to support movements of the infantry, there's no speed there. But if you have a tank division where like the entire division is just tanks, you can drive a lot faster. You can do these broad, you know, miles and miles and miles and miles and miles encircling movements. And the Germans got that. They executed it in Poland. And like when you're completely surrounded and completely cut off from your supplies, like I don't know how many of our listeners have gone camping, but you can imagine like you can only physically carry enough food to feed yourself for just a few days. Once you go through that, like you are completely dependent upon your immediate vicinity. You're fighting with food for other people. My point is like once you're encircled and cut off, like you're looking at like a week before you start starving. And what that psychologically does to you when you've got tank divisions in your rear and you're getting bombed and strafed by the Luftwaffe and you've got, you know, you're basically surrounded, that does something to you. So people, and this would be a thing throughout World War II, you just surrender. Like hundreds of thousands of troop formations in the Soviets, they would surrender in the hundreds of thousands, more like the thousands and tens of thousands in Poland. And they were able to do this because of these broad tank movements. And I kind of already mentioned it. The other technological advance that de Gaulle saw that nobody in France wanted to pay attention to was their integration between the Stuka dive bomber and tanks. Like, they would put these dive bombers in direct support of these large tank columns to just bomb the bejesus out of defenders, and the tanks would just roll right on, punch through the lines, get in the rear, disrupt the supply lines, you know, as basically this impregnable cavalry. And it was extremely effective.
It's interesting because American doctrine is definitely adopted, like close air support, deep air support, having an assigned main effort. Like, the Germans built the Blitzkrieg and designed it around tanks, like you mentioned. So everything was in support of the tank. So they would mechanize their infantry so they could keep up with the tanks. So everything in their doctrine and their strategy was designed around supporting a tank. So how can I get I need infantry. How can I get them to the front fast enough to support the tank? We'll put them on trucks. So we have to have divisions of trucks to take all of these infantrymen. How do we supply all of these tanks with fuel, diesel fuel? How do we get, you know, rations out to the infantry that are supporting the tanks? How do we integrate fires from both artillery, indirect fires, direct fire from tanks, and then aircraft, which, you know, the close and deep air support? It's very similar. And I don't want to digress too much from World War II, but in the US, there was a similar type of discussion going on amongst some of the future stars in the American military during the interwar period, with Eisenhower and Patton, who were kind of mid-level in the 20s, in the late 20s. They would have been like colonels, I believe. At the time, they were fighting amongst, not really fighting, but there was a divide amongst American generals of the use of infantry and cavalry still versus the tank. And Eisenhower and Patton believed in the power of the tank as the future of modern warfare at the time. And they received a lot of blowback from American generals. Patton kind of backed down to save face politically, if you will, but Eisenhower didn't. And obviously you can see how their career trajectories changed. But it's interesting that within France, the US and Germany, they were all trying to decide how to fight World War II that they knew might come, and how would they bet. And obviously France didn't prepare appropriately. They didn't look at the horrors of World War I and adapt. And the US was still kind of partial, but luckily we had an ocean to buy us some time to figure it out, whereas the Germans were rapidly changing their doctrine. So I just wanted to make that point that even the US was suffering from that at the time.
Yeah. There's a fantastic book. It was one of the more enjoyable reads in the history. It's called Military Innovation in the Interwar Years by Williamson Murray and Alan Millett. And it is, if you are a history nerd, World War II nerd, military nerd, like, you've got to read Williamson and Millett. That book is fantastic. And they definitely talk about the British. Also, I forget the trials that they did, but JFC Fuller was a big fan of the tank. B.H. Little Hart was a big fan of the tank. And
what about Bernard Montgomery, old Bernie?
Yeah. You know, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I know Montgomery was a big fan of paratroopers that didn't work out so great for him.
Did not. It was a bridge too far, if you will.
It was a bridge too far, if you will. How about that?
Great movie reference for anyone that did pick up on that.
Yeah. It's a book too, ain't it? Wasn't it a book first?
I don't know. It shows how well read I am. I'm referencing the movie.
I think the movie was way more popular. There's definitely a movie.
What? For this episode, we're going to give a movie recommendation. It's A Bridge Too Far.
Too far, yeah. Yeah, so honestly, I think, you know, this is kind of one of the things that I wanted to discuss at some point during this episode. And that really is, like, I don't know how to phrase it. Like, one of the indicators
and warnings.
Yeah. One of the indicators of, like, your country's in trouble is when innovation ceases and you get this, like, rigid, dare I say, conservatism that is not able to adjust with the times. Now, of course, that can be super unhelpful in a lot of ways, but, like, when it comes to military technology, you know, the French military was extremely conservative. And I don't mean merely politically, although that is true. I mean that in terms of they were just constantly looking backwards, and they viewed World War One as like their heyday. Even though it's weird, Americans look at World War One and we were like, that was just really bad tactics across the board. And
it was only 11 months long, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think we follow more of the British literary tradition in that viewing World War One as just this senseless slaughter. Mm-hmm. But in France, it was viewed as like their glory. And so you had guys like Gamelin, you got guys like, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Georges, who's the chief of staff under Gamelin and the commander of the immediate armies there on the front in World War II. They were just like stuck in their ways. Whereas in Germany, which was also an extremely conservative state under fascism, they weren't technologically stuck. Like they were able to move forward, and the Germans and the German general staff, you know, were brilliant, by the way, from a military standpoint. So de Gaulle, bringing it back to France here, de Gaulle was unsuccessful. And at the time of 1940, when the Germans invaded, the basic tank formation in France was a division of half tanks and half cavalry.
That doesn't surprise me. It's interesting looking at that evolution of warfare between those two countries, because the Germans wanted to be innovative, but they also used opportunities. And this is kind of another reason that appeasement didn't work, because the fact that they didn't go and try and stop the Germans meant that they were behind the curve, because the Germans were out learning how to employ these tanks. So they utilized Czechoslovakia, Poland. They used that as learning opportunities, how they could refine their process. Like when we talked about it an episode or two ago, when they invaded Czechoslovakia, most of their armor was patched up with wooden plywood in places. So it was just appearance, but they were practicing the doctrine. And so when they invaded France with those 10 divisions of panzers, they had it down to a science of where they needed to attack, how they needed to coordinate, because a lot of people don't understand warfare being waged at that scale requires a lot of coordination. And so we'll see this as once they collapse the French, there's no coordination that was occurring. And so because they chose 8 years prior not to really start putting a stop to Hitler, they also lost the opportunity to learn how to counter them effectively. And so they were still fighting. It's almost like looking like they were fighting a battle in 1930 where they had some cavalry, some tanks, but the Germans were fighting in 1940. So it was like a decade of difference between the two of development. Yeah. You know, it's just kind of another angle if you want to look. Even if they lost the engagement in appeasement, chances are they would have learned a lot more and the stakes were so much lower. It would have been probably minor skirmishes and then a peace drawn up afterward, but they would have learned something.
Yeah, no, that's learning is a great way to put it. Like learning was happening at scale in Germany and it wasn't happening at all in France. And that shows in the battlefield come 1940. Speaking of which, one of my favorite dudes in history is Erich von Manstein. And Manstein wrote a phenomenal memoir called Lost Victories. He was one of the few German generals who did not he was acquitted either at Nuremberg or before Nuremberg, but he lived into the 80s. Like he was cleared. He was good. Like Manstein's record was clean, even being a general in Nazi Europe. And Manstein was an unknown, mid-level officer in 1940. And his rise began when after Germany invaded Poland, come November, Hitler wanted to to start the invasion on the other side. He didn't want to delay. But due to weather, once winter set in, things were bad. Well, come January, February, a plane that had two officers inside, two German officers. They crash landed in Belgium, and it had, and they had with them the entire German invasion plan. And this invasion plan, they landed in Belgium. The Belgian police and intelligence services captured them. One of the officers tried taking the papers and burning them. The Belgians were able to stamp it out before he could burn the papers. They like laid it on a table. The officer then picked up the papers and put his hand in a fire to try to burn, like burnt the daylights out of his own hand, trying to destroy the papers. And that's what convinced the Belgians. They're like, wait a minute, this isn't a plan. Like, this dude almost set his hand on fire trying to, and like injured himself trying to burn the papers. And it was like, it was the actual, like it freaked Hitler out, and it caused another delay because the Germans at that time were planning basically the Schlieffen plan all over again. The one difference was is that they were going to also invade the Netherlands, whereas in World War One, the Schlieffen plan was almost exclusively through Belgium and northern France. This was basically a strong right wing was going to sweep down and basically do a large outflanking movement all the way to Paris. Well, when those plans got captured by the Belgians, and the Belgians kind of shared it with the French. I don't think we have time to go into that whole story, but the Belgians were like strictly neutral. And they were like, we're not helping anybody out here. Even though it's like, they're literally on your border about to invade you, dude. You just capture the plans and you're not going to share it with France. Anyway, they eventually did in part. And the Germans weren't going to change the plan. They were just kind of like, the territory demands that this is where we go. Well, this guy named Eric von Manstein shows up and he goes, hey, I've got a different idea. Instead of making our far right flank the main effort, let's make the center the main effort, reinforce them with more tank divisions, and have them push through the Ardennes, which was a densely wooded forest, have them push through the Ardennes and go all the way to the English Channel, as opposed to a strong right wing, which would sweep parallel to the channel and come down on top of Paris, which was what the plan was in World War One. They were saying, Manstein was saying, let's push the tanks through the Ardennes and go straight to the channel. And what that, and he was betting that as soon as an invasion started, the French would send the bulk of their forces into Belgium. Well, the Ardennes is kind of southern Belgium, right at, you know, around Luxembourg, southern Belgium area. And he's like, if we can do that and go to the channel and the French send the majority of their divisions into the Netherlands, into Belgium, we can completely cut them off. And he talks about how like the original plan was only, could have only at best delivered a partial victory. Whereas this plan, it is able to deliver total victory. And he's right. And Manstein, what's funny is even in the German command, they didn't like it. They told him to shut up. They actually promoted him to be a corps commander of a corps that was like in the middle of Germany, like doing security. Through a twist of fate, Manstein ended up getting like a lunch or a breakfast with Hitler himself. And Hitler like made an oft comment about, I've been thinking about reinforcing the center. And Manstein was like, yes, I would love to talk to you more about that. And Hitler like invited him into a study. Manstein had a private one-on-one with Hitler himself. And he laid out his entire plan. Hitler left his study and was reportedly said, that guy, he's not my cup of tea, but I think he thinks rightly.
It's a very interesting statement.
Manstein was also a devout Christian. Like he was very conservative. That's part of the reason that kept him out of trouble when, you know, they're murdering Jews and others. Manstein, we won't go into it in this podcast series, but Manstein would later be the German army group commander at Stalingrad. And he was the guy. So there was, you know, kind of like the crescendo of Stalingrad was there were several, I think it was an entire German army got surrounded. And they got surrounded in Stalingrad because Hitler said, hold that city at all costs, don't retreat. Well, when more and more and more Russians started showing up, Manstein was like, we need to withdraw. They're going to get surrounded. And Hitler was like, no. And Manstein had to like call the army commander. You know, I'm pretty sure he was an army group commander. So he had multiple armies underneath him. Like, this is a butt ton of soldiers. He had to call the guy and be like, hey, man, like, you're on your own. We can't come get you. Like, we can continue to drop off supplies, but we even need to like withdraw, blah, 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 blah. And that's kind of like the tragedy of Manstein's like personal story during World War II. So Manstein is a fascinating guy, but he's the architect of sending the main effort through the Ardennes. And his book, Lost Victories, is fascinating. So good. I think it should be made a movie, but that's another story. So I wanted to read a quote from the book that I've been using as my source, which is William Schur's The Collapse of the Third Republic. And here he's kind of talking about, you know, the Germans were able to adapt. The Germans were able, you know, their plan got captured. There were free think, you know, there was the German equivalent to de Gaulle, right? We talked about how de Gaulle was like, we need to change, we need to adapt. And nobody listened. Whereas you had Manstein on the other side, and he's like, hey, I got a new plan, we need to change. And there was some initial resistance, but even Hitler himself was able to adapt and change the plan. Well, this is a paragraph where Schur is talking about Gamblin, the chief of the French military, and he was talking about how just like intellectually inflexible he was. And he writes, speaking about Gamblin, he says, actually, the Generalissimo did not know the first day of battle the direction of the main German attack and never found it out, despite repeated warnings, until it was too late. He stuck doggedly to his preconceived strategy until it was too late. Unmindful of a famous remark of Moltke, the victor over France in 1870, so Moltke the Elder, Moltke the Younger would have been the guy in charge during World War I. So unmindful of the famous remark of Moltke, the victor over France in 1870, whom he must surely have read since he was an avid student of military history, that, quote, a mistake in the initial deployment of an army can never again be made good in the whole course of the war, end quote. Joffre, to be sure, had disproved that in the Battle of the Marne in 1914, and Gamblin, as phlegmatic as his chief, had helped him. That last little thing there was, you know, Gamblin's prestige was because Joffre. So, yeah, it looks like Joffre in English, but it's Joffre in French. Well, Gamblin was Joffre's like aide-de-camp or chief of staff or something like that. And that's where he kind of got. And Joffre was the senior French military guy in World War I. And he was like the hero of, you know, the savior of France because he stopped the German advance. And what Schur is talking about how Joffre disproved that was at the beginning of the battle in August of 1914, France's military was not in the right spot. But because of von Kluck's blunder east of Paris, they were able to take advantage of it and were able to actually flank him from Paris. So they were able to recover. But the point here that Schur is trying to bring up is that part of the reason why France just tactically got obliterated in May of 1914 was because of Gamblin's intellectual rigidity, and he couldn't adapt to a new situation.
How did the order of battle proceed from there on? You know, how did Gamblin react or not react? And then, you know, walk us through that little stretch of a few weeks, really.
Yeah. So essentially, So on May 10th is when Germany invaded. France would sign an armistice on June 22nd. So 6 weeks later, this would all be over. And in summary, basically what happened was the Netherlands only had like 8 divisions in their entire army. Like they had basically nobody. I think the Belgians had like 20 or 30 or something like that. They had a much larger army. And the Netherlands fell extremely fast. The Belgians kind of held on for a little bit. Well, in what Manstein suspected was the French army like rapidly went north once the invasion started. And that's when Guderian started his push through the Ardennes. And there was one battle, or one key battle, kind of seen as like the key moment in the entire. Yeah, the key moment here is known as the Battle of Sedan, which Sedan is is like the city or the town between in French and German military history, because Sedan was also the place of the battle during the Franco-Prussian War, where the French got obliterated, that led to the proclamation of a united Germany and the Treaty of in the Palace at Versailles. And in World War I, they talked about avenging Sedan in that humiliation. Well, here again, we see, you know, Sedan is on the other side of the Ardennes, on the west side of the Ardennes. And Gamelin put 3 tank divisions through the Ardennes, and that the west side was one of the most weakly defended points from the French military. So like the majority of the French...
Gamelin put 3 divisions?
Oh, sorry, Guderian.
Okay.
Guderian, sorry. Guderian put 3 divisions through the Ardennes, popped out on the other side, and the French were completely taken by surprise. And you can imagine, like, if you're about to get in a fight with somebody, this is the effect of surprise on a battle. If you are in the middle of a fight, say like you're a boxer, you're walking into a boxing ring, you know, you do the hype, you've got the hype song, you're getting mentally prepared, you're looking at your opponent, you walk in the ring, you shake around, you touch gloves, and then you start swinging, right? Zero surprise up until that point. Now imagine that exact same situation. You've been asleep for 3 hours, and all of a sudden in your sleep, you just are getting punched in the face. You're laying in your bed. Somebody's just pounding you in the face. And you're just like, what? What the heck's going on? That is the effect of surprise. Like, it is, you are not prepared. Like, and it's kind of, I like that analogy, because surprise is not like walking into your own home and somebody throws a surprise birthday party for you. That's not the same kind of surprise in a military context, right? Like, it's surprise, and then you get to like enjoy, you're able to recover, like blah, 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 blah. Military context of surprise is you're getting punched in the face.
It's literally life or death.
Yes. And you're just like, boom, 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 boom. Like, and so I bring that up to say, like, the French were very certain that no armored formations could make it through the Ardennes. And just to make this super clear, the reason why is because the only way you can drive vehicles through the woods is if there are roads. You can't go off the beaten path, right? It's if there are woods. Well, the idea of the time was that, well, if you concentrate your mechanized or your armored forces, so mechanized is technically not correct, your armored forces on these roads, they become extremely suspect to artillery, to aerial interdiction, that kind of thing. You're concentrating your forces, thus increasing the effects of like kinetic type stuff on these roads. Heck, you could just bomb the roads and you create these and deny the use of the roads themselves to the armored formations. Well, what the French assumed was, because of that fact, the Germans weren't going to try to put armored divisions through the Ardennes. What the French failed to realize was that the Germans not only were going to try to do it, they were going to try to do it as their main effort. So, and they weren't expecting it. So they weren't ready. They weren't even looking. There were no French bombers, like, even around. the Schur actually goes at length to talk about how, like, in May 10th, 1940, the French air forces were actually somewhat at parity with the German air forces. They were just napping. They, like, weren't even in the fight. Again, they were sleeping on their beds and then just started getting their face caved in. And similarly with artillery fire, like, they weren't even looking. There was no observation. You know, this is pre, you know, satellite days. So it's like, if you don't have usually a physical forward observer in these areas, like, you're just not going to know. And all of a sudden, like, the tanks, the Panzers pop out on the west side of the forest. And they're like, oh, shoot. And the Germans used the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, to great effect. And that is the, like, even before the tanks got there, they were getting blown to smithereens. And effectively what that did was, even though there were French defenders there, they couldn't organize a defense, period. Like, they got obliterated on the other side of the Meuse, the river. So Guderian was able to very quickly, he had engineers in support. So there's, like, this combined arms effect, which was very new for the time. His engineers went forward. They were able to secure the bridges across the Meuse. And that was kind of the fait accompli. There was, once that initial, like, light French defense was obliterated and they'd secured the bridgeheads, there was nothing in between Guderian and the English Channel. And so everything after that point was just kind of a matter of course. That's why it all happened so quickly. They completely surrounded the French. They completely surrounded the British Expeditionary Force. I wasn't going to talk too much about it, but this is Dunkirk. Like, the reason why Dunkirk was such a big deal was because Guderian and all these soldiers were south of them at the time. They were completely surrounded.
Go ahead. I think there's a great book called The Lightning War, Blitzkrieg, and it talks through, like, this invasion, like, these couple weeks. And it kind of tells it from both perspectives, like, hey, what the Germans were doing and then the Allies. Because at this point, the British Expeditionary Force was onshore in France to help support the French. And the British Expeditionary Force was led by a General Gort. I think it was Lord Gort as well, also known as, but it was General Gort. And prior to, you know, during the phony war period and all that, like, he was kind of looked down on as this kind of a simpleton. I don't want to, maybe that's a little bit harsh, but, like, in one of the staff meetings, he brought up keeping the soldiers' shoes shined. It's a tongue twister for you. And they kind of laughed at him. But, like, while this happened, so once Guderian had sent the main effort through the Ardennes and all hell broke loose, and the French command, which, you know, Gamelin had no idea what was happening, was not communicating with his subordinates on any kind of defense. Like I mentioned, they had no practice reps, so they had no idea what to do when it came. Yeah. I think it was on, like, the 21st of May. So this is, like, 11 days after the invasion began. General Gort basically just, like, took an assessment of the situation, was just like, okay, the Germans have overrun the French. We are being surrounded as we speak. He basically had to make a decision by himself because he wasn't getting it from the French and he really wasn't getting much from Great Britain. So he's just like, okay, I'm literally turning this army around and we're marching straight to Dunkirk. Otherwise, the entire British Expeditionary Force is going to be captured. Yeah. And so I think it was just kind of a twist of fate where, like, one guy, and great general or not, I don't know how he was on the battlefield, but he just made a decision like, okay, in the absence of orders, I have to make a decision here. And it may have saved Great Britain if you think about it. Like, the British Expeditionary Force was thousands of British troops who made it to Dunkirk and were able to effectively withdraw from France and literally live to fight another day. Had they not been able to fight another day, I'm not saying that would have turned the tide of the war, maybe, but it would have significantly decreased the chances of the Allies putting up a sustained resistance in Great Britain from the Germans, because they would have lost tens of thousands of troops. Yeah. I just thought that was one interesting story, kind of the simpleton general making a solid decision to get the heck out of there in the absence of all. And in the book, it talks about, like, like, the sheer chaos and uncertainty that was existing among, because the British and the French weren't really talking together. They didn't really know what the Belgians were going to do.
Yeah.
Like, the Belgians and the, sucked. You know, they didn't really finish the Maginot Line. you know, the Maginot Line, like France did their part, but it's never really completed. And, you know, they didn't really coordinate and work well together. And then so the French, who were being invaded and were supposed to be leading this resistance, were just not issuing any orders. There was like, so you're talking about surprise at like a tactical level where there's this face punch where these tanks are busting out of the forest and Stukas are dive bombing you. Well, at an operational and strategic level, if you take it back, like the French had no idea what to do. They were so surprised. They got punched in the face. It's like, well, I'm not getting any reports. I don't know what to do. It's like they just froze. It's, you know, you hear the fight or flight. Well, fight, flight, or freeze. And they kind of just froze and got overwhelmed.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't talked about it yet in this episode, but there was also, you know, defeatism was ripe or rife in throughout the French army. So it was just kind of like, there was no strong will to resist. And Marc Bloch talks about how, like, you would see French, like, kind of retreating, going back towards Paris. And he's like, I don't even hear gunfire. What are you retreating from? And it was just kind of like this, oh, well, we heard up ahead we're getting overrun, so we're going to leave too. And it was like nobody believed in France. And that's one reason why he calls his book Strange Defeat, because it's like, are we even trying right now?
26 years prior, there was the miracle on the Marne where they made that resistance. And then now they're just kind of like, oh, there's some gunfire up ahead. I'm going to surrender now before it even starts coming at me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, kind of the anti-climax, I guess, of this whole invasion is, by June 11th, the French government declared Paris a, quote, open city. And that was just, they were basically trying to say, like, they preemptively told the Germans, we're not going to resist you. Please just don't bomb us. And by the 14th of June, the Germans were walking through. Hitler was getting his freaking selfies in front of the Eiffel Tower. And there was no resistance at all to German forces going into Paris. And it's like, man, how the turntables.
How the turntables turn.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm glad you brought up, Colin, communication, because I didn't get into it too much before, but not only just from a technological standpoint, but one of the key factors was that nobody really knew who was in charge on the French side. There was a lot of squabbling between the French, the Germans, the French, the British, and the Belgians on who is going to be in charge and these like tactical formations. Yeah. So General George was the actual like tactical commander of the entire French army that was supposed to like be in the battle. Whereas Gamelin was like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Like, he was just the senior military guy. He wasn't like a tactical commander. And like the two barely talked to one another the entire time.
The Prime Minister. Like,
yeah. Renault. And I actually skipped this fact. Renault, he had, you know, previous episodes we talked about Daladier was the Prime Minister. Well, Daladier ended up resigning and was replaced by a guy named Renault. And Renault and Daladier were rivals. They didn't like each other. Well, Daladier and Gamelin were boys, but he stepped down. Renault was the new prime minister, and he wanted to get rid of Gamelin. But Daladier was still in the cabinet. He was the minister of war, even after he got fired as the prime minister. And he's like trying to protect Gamelin. Anyway, this all was a big debacle. And Renault was trying to get Gamelin after the invasion. He's like, are you doing anything? And Gamelin's response was like, hey, I don't want to stress anybody out. It was kind of like, they're the commanders. I would hate it if somebody came and micromanaged me. And he was like, dude, we're getting invaded, man. Like, they're coming for us. Like, and what are you doing about it? Anyway, there was like just a lot of dysfunction.
I feel like that's kind of like the dog. It's like the dog in the burning house was like, this is fine. I don't want to be. I'm not.
Oh,
I don't wanna,
yes.
Yep. This is fine.
I'm in danger.
I'm in danger. Yeah. There's tanks in the Ardennes. I'm in danger.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. That was. Yeah. Gamelin does not get a good rap in history because it was just like so blatantly obvious. And this dude was just like living in his own world.
I don't want to be an ageist here. But there, you pass a certain threshold in age where, like, Gamblin was an old man at this point. Like, I can't remember. We talked about it in one of the last episodes. Like, he had been in the service for like 50 years, just about at this point. He wasn't, like, the guy's tired. If you're going to be.
I think he's in his 60s. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you think about the stress and what you're going to, even as a leader, like, you're not on the front lines. I get that. But you're going to be having sleepless nights where you are constantly giving orders and you are met. You have to have a certain level of, like, energy and vitality just to carry the weight of that defense. Like, it's on you. The guy's an old man. He just wants to take a nap. Like, he had no, like, you talk about, like, the perfect embodiment of the spirit of France at the at that time. It was an old man who was basking in the glory of World War One. Not this.
Yes.
Not a forward. You know, the Germans, to their credit, their generals were not just old, old men basking in the glory of World War One. They learned from them. They learned from them as they're in their proper places, kind of role models, mentors type of thing. But they were innovative and they were young enough that they could maintain the weight of an operation like this. The French didn't do that. And, you know, the British probably did it to an extent as well, but not as bad as the French. I just, Gamelin's like, he just encapsulates exactly what it was to be French in 1940. Yeah.
Yes, it's true. And I don't know about our listeners, but like,
our demographics tell me that it's. I'm not going to offend too many people by that ageism.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, I know Colin and I, we've been in situations where we've been required to stay up for long periods of time, like over 24 hours, and continue to, like, make decisions, do physically demanding things, like, you know, even just for a day or two where you just don't sleep. And if you've never been in that situation before, just try it for fun. see how much, how well your brain works after just missing one night of sleep. Like, your brain does not work very well. And Colin and I are not old. We're in our 30s. Like, in the last time, at least I think for both of us, Colin, I'll speak for myself. Last time I did something like that was in my 20s. So I was like, had a lot more energy. Was a lot more physically capable, I guess. And after you lose one night of sleep, at least for me, all I wanted to do was go to sleep. Like, it was like this weight that just hangs over your head. It's not like, it's easier to not eat than it is to not sleep, at least for me.
The physiological and psychological stress from not sleeping, because then you're also probably not going to be eating very much. More than likely, you're going to miss meals during those times. So, and that tends to happen, but
so you can imagine how, go ahead.
I was going to say, you are, they've done studies on it, like, where you have a lack of sleep. It's like less than, if you have like 4 hours of sleep, they're like equated to having a certain number of drinks of alcohol. And like,
yes,
unless you're a heavy drinker.
Very similar effect.
Yeah. Yes. Unless you're a heavy drinker, having a BAC of like 0.008, like, it's past the legal limit of driving. Like, that's not, and now imagine doing that sustained, your body's hormones react, you're in a constant fight or flight. And you would probably have to do this, like, not just days, but potentially weeks at a time, where you're constantly, your nation is being invaded. Like, you got to kick it into gear. And he's just too old.
This is war.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, that's why I bring it up. Because it's like, you know, your country needs you the most right now. He was probably getting full nights of sleep and his brain wasn't working that well. Much less, how well is it working, like, in the middle of the greatest onslaught your nation has ever faced?
Not to judge our current leaders, but
age is very much a consideration in this upcoming.
It is very much cycle. A consideration for a lot of people, as it should for all people making decisions that affect your life. But it's kind of like, hey, we're staring at this enemy to the east, you know, and there's war going on. War is potentially at the gates. Does your commander in chief have the wherewithal to negotiate or make the wartime decisions? Yeah. That's an important factor that you have to consider. Yeah. Gamelin did not. And Gamelin was just the general. He wasn't, you know, he was just the general. He was just in charge of defense, let alone the rest of the nation.
Who's the guy that said war is far too significant a thing to be left to the generals? God, who said something like that?
I don't know. I'm gonna have to fact check it.
So there, that's not an exact quote, but it's pretty close. Yeah, war is far too important a matter to be left to the generals or something like that. I feel like it was an American, but I'm not sure. Part of me says Abraham Lincoln. I don't know.
Like war, peace is too important to be left to the generals. That is, hold on.
Peace.
You know what? I'll find it. FDR said it. War is too important to be left to the generals. FDR. Okay, that makes sense. I was going to say his Uncle Teddy, but he didn't really have a war like this.
Yeah. I just, ChatGPT says it's Georges Clemenceau.
The French guy?
I almost wonder if ChatGPT is making that up.
Finding a real life.
I think you're right. I think it was Roosevelt. That sounds right.
For any of our listeners, feel free to fact check us.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's... We can honestly hate on Gamelin all day long. But anyway, the invasion of France, it all comes to its conclusion with Germans on the 14th of June signing it or walking into Paris, and it was all over. The government had fled by that point. And on the 22nd, France would sign an armistice with Germany, and we would enter the time of Vichy France and free France with de Gaulle in London. Just to kind of wrap things up here, I wanted to just kind of think about, we've talked about the topics, like we've seen, the dysfunctional communication. We've talked about the age considerations. We've talked about the inflexibility of the German leadership. The one thing that I wanted to hit before we wrap up is complacency. And I talked a little bit about defeatism, but one of the key themes, as we've talked about this entire series, is that part of the problem of the Third Republic was that people didn't want it to survive. And there was very much this like dissatisfaction with just the Republic writ large, bringing it back to the Dreyfus Affair. Like, people didn't believe in the idea of the Third Republic anymore. And that was, it's not like just civilian person thought that. Like, the French military, the people who were, tasked to defend their country, they were the ones also that were just tired and had it with the Third Republic. And I just kind of wanted to bring that up because I think that's one of the main reasons why there was no will to fight. Colin, you've talked about that a lot in this series, is like, where there's a will, there's a way. And if there's no will, like, people are not going to fight. I actually think, I'm interested what you have to say this, Colin. I'm going to say something, and I don't know if I believe it 100%, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. I actually don't think America has anywhere close to a similar level of complacency as France did at that time. I think a lot of Americans still very much care about, our Constitution, about what it stands for. Not even saying that all of those Americans agree with one another, but people like... I just don't see a lot of conversation about alternate systems to the republic that we have. And I don't know. I don't know if I see the same level of complacency. So for me, that's a difference. I see a difference between America and France. What do you think?
I see us closing in fast on that. I mean, it's kind of a pessimistic view, but I mean, like, think about the level of mistrust within the government now because of COVID. Think of how that polarized people, and it polarized them. It accelerated already splintering, kind of a fracture that has been occurring from a two-party system that we've had for years. But it really just, it took, it's kind of like if you look at a dam and it has a small crack, and now suddenly like it just bust wide open. Mm-hmm. I think there's a number of people that still deeply care about the Constitution, but I'm kind of observing a widening gap of people that, for whatever leaning they have, find reasons where they just altogether want to completely alter the system. I mean, there's some people who want to, like, January 6th, quote unquote, overthrow the government and overturn the elections. Well, like the same people on the opposite side of this political spectrum, absolutely 100% surrounded the White House with the sitting president of the United States and were very like a few moments away from storming the White House, like in some kind of French Revolution, like Bastille Day type of scenario. Mm. Those things don't happen in like a healthy functioning nation. And both of them occurred by people on opposite ends of the spectrum. And my point in saying that is it's widening. The things that you see now didn't exist 20 years ago. Heck, 20 years ago, it was American flags everywhere. Now, like there's articles where people question, should we fly the American? If you're questioning flying the American flag, like, I'm sorry, that's not a value I share.
Yeah.
But the important part is like, how are you then going to convince that person who is ashamed of the flag to go fight a war on behalf of it? That's the big problem here. It's one thing to say like, hey, I disagree with something that is very popular in the United States, or I think it stands for. It's another thing altogether to reject what that nation is while living there and then be asked to go fight for it. So in France, though we have some differences with what they were feeling prior to World War II, it's very similar in the sense that who's going to do the fighting? Like, are you going to go the hardcore, you know, Republicans of 2003, like, they don't really exist in numbers to go fight. Are you going to select the kid who's protesting nonstop and wants to say like, the entire system of America was founded on some form of white supremacy. Do you think that person's going to go fight for it? If they believe that the government as the government as it stands is evil, why would they then go turn around and fight for it? And like, those are questions we need to wrestle with, because like, should a war like with China or Russia break out, who's actually going to do the fighting? Who's the general in charge? Does Milley inspire the confidence of a general that can do great things? Yeah, no doubt. Yeah,
does Milley?
I mean, Milley can give me a lecture on, you know, the current reading trends, but can he lead a defense of the country? Can he architect an invasion? I don't know. Does our political class as a whole, the executive, the legislative, do they inspire people to say, you know what, I want to defend this? It's hard to, when you ask questions like that, it's hard to see, like, do we have a lot of people willing to do that? I mean, it's almost kind of like harkening back to the 60s where people didn't want to go fight in Vietnam for good reason. They didn't want to go fight in Vietnam for good reason. So we had to do a draft. Yeah. If you were to do a draft now, how would we respond to that? Could you even find enough able-bodied people to draft? It's hard to say. Yeah. So I have a very pessimistic view right now. Should an external threat really pop up like Germany did to France in 1940, that we would be effective in defeating it without a lot of pain at first? Very pessimistic answer.
I actually disagree with you, Colin.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. And it's funny you brought up the 1960s, because that's what I was thinking of. I was like, I feel like things were worse in the 60s. Like, that's just one point that it's like, yeah, I know things feel bad right now, but I also feel like there's a generational perspective. You and I grew up in the 90s where, you know, it was a whole bunch of kumbaya, not a bunch of dissension, right? Our parents grew up either like, you know, late 60s, 70s, but really the 80s, which the 80s were also like, you know, we had Ronnie Reagan in office and, you know, we really stuck it to those commies. You know, we won the Cold War, that kind of thing. I think it's our grandparents' generation that like really saw the 60s for what it was, because they know what it was like in the 50s. It's one thing to be born in the 60s, which I don't know about you, but my parents were born in the 60s. it was like they were kids when all that, you know, craziness was going on. I'm sure they remember it, but like they were kids.
They didn't have an appreciation for it as a young adult.
Right. In the same way that I don't think I had an appreciation for what was going on in the 90s, right? Like it was, I was a kid. I was growing up in the 90s, but I didn't truly understand. I was like, why is Rush Limbaugh so mad? Why is everything he not like Bill great. Clinton? Bill Clinton is terrible because Rush says so, right? Like,
You know, the reason I formed my opinion, if I had just seen a lot of this on the internet or the news cycle, mm-hmm. I would do what I had done for a long time and just assume that there are people that exist and they're terminally online and they're angry. You think your uncle on Facebook.
Yeah.
But the reality is almost every extended conversation you have with somebody, even a stranger, I know it's difficult, especially for our Zoomers out there, to go out there and pick up a conversation with a real person and make eye contact with them for a long time. But if you have an extended conversation, just throw out semi-political, you know, geopolitical, you know, national topics of interest, like just kind of throw some of those feelers out and, you know, just see what take the temperature of that conversation and see what kind of things will come up. You're hearing things now that the fact that a Civil War 2.0 is even discussed in everyday people's, they're talking about it outside of the internet. That's the crazy thing. That's where I'm like, oh, okay, that's my canary in a coal mine. When something like that is brought up by, like, not crazy Uncle Dan on Facebook, but it's like, hey, my 25-year-old coworker who went to an Ivy League school suddenly dropped it, started talking about Civil War and saw some memes and thinks it might actually happen. You're like, okay,
it's not happening.
I'm talking to this guy in real life. He got something from the internet, but now he's thinking about it and he's openly discussing it. You're like, okay, something's going on here. Or you talk to your aunt and she's who's never watched the news ever and had opinions that are still dated in the 90s. And you're like, okay, well, they're talking about all of these issues that are going on in a way that would not have been deemed, like, not even politically correct, but almost like discussed in a polite society circa 2002. Just wouldn't have happened. And it is mainstream everyday conversation now. That's my canary in the coal mine. And that's why I give caution and think, okay, we got to really do some serious soul searching as a nation here. Should the time come to respond in earnest to a real external threat?
Yeah, I don't know.
We're just two guys on a podcast.
It's like the freaking ain't nobody gonna fight no daggum Civil War. You're gonna stay at home and you're gonna complain about it on social media.
The fact is, people are talking about it. That's the scary thing. In 2010,
I think they talk about it because they're watching too many movies.
In 2010, nobody was saying that outside of the internet. In 2024, people are actually like, well, this is what it would actually look like. And you're like, okay, it's almost becoming like a game now. They're almost manifesting it on themselves by talking it through. And it's kind of, and I say these pessimistic things not to say like, we're doomed. It's over. It's like, no, let's take pause and see where we're at. Let's try and fix it before it's too late. It's okay to notice what's going on, rightly call it out and say, like, I think we need a course correct here. Not saying that we're on the brink of a Civil War 2.0, but like, hey, maybe things we don't want to continue on this current trajectory. Staying on this current trajectory might lead to some unwanted consequences. A Civil War, probably not, but potentially a draft happening and nobody actually wanting to go fight. That's kind of realistic. That's more realistic.
Oh, that's super real. Yeah, that's super realistic.
Exactly.
Again, it happened in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, you had riots and kids getting shot on a university because they didn't want to go fight. You had people getting beat. It was not a good time. I think it would be worse now if that happened than then.
Yeah, I actually think I agree with you. If there was a cause for it.
It's all a matter of caution. That's what I'm trying to give and saying, like, hey, the path we're going down right now kind of eerily looks similar to France circa the 1930s. We can fix things. And everything is not going to look the same, right? It's not always going to be the same. And that's okay. It's not going to. The point of these Jay and I talking about this is to say, like, hey, recognize what happened in the past so you can fix it in the future and you're not doomed to repeat it, because it always seems to happen. You're just doomed to repeat it. I'll stop my diatribe now.
No, I like it. And with that, I actually think that's a good place for us to cut it off.
Do you want to summarize?
Yeah, sure. So man, great discussion, Colin. But you know what? I hope everyone out there has a good friend like I do that you can talk to and, you know, still laugh and chuckle even when you disagree about things, and it'll be okay. And we'll still
be friends tomorrow. It's okay to disagree.
You know, that right there would go a really long way in, I think, healing a lot of the divides, is knowing is like, you don't have to go scorched earth on the person. As a matter of fact, like, it's better to just walk away. Like, if you can't emotionally, like, cope with somebody else disagreeing with you, it's best to just kind of go, okay, I'm just going to go my own way. You don't have to go scorched earth. I hate you now. You are my mortal
enemy.
You're
dead to me. You're dead to me.
You're dead to me. You disagreed. We disagree about something. Anyway, thank you, Colin, for the good discussion. And, you know, as we're getting towards the end of this Fall of France series, I think we really saw a lot of the earlier topics that we've brought up in previous episodes, you know, especially ones like, you know, the French military having trouble adjusting with the times, you know, De Gaulle getting shot down, and how Germany really took the new technology and used it to their advantage. And how that came in. You know, we talked about the fall of Paris. We talked about how there wasn't really a resistance. And in our next episode, we're going to talk about Vichy France, and we're going to kind of sum up what's going on here in, you know, the big lessons learned from the fall of the French Third Republic.
In closing, if you like what we're doing at the Loins of History, give us a like and a comment on YouTube, or a like, a 5-star review, and a comment so we can see and give you a shout out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, something like that, one of those platforms. We do like getting feedback as well on Gmail or social media. We're both on at some form of Loins of History. And with that, I will close this out, and we'll see you next week as we continue this series on the fall of the French Third Republic. Break, break, short and sweet.